Imagine for a second that you are standing in the middle of a massive crowded shopping mall.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
Right, but this isn't a normal mall. Every time you glance at a specific storefront, the physical walls literally shift to box you in.
Oh, wow. That sounds mildly terrifying.
Right, and the exits actually move further away based on how fast your heart is beating. The prices on the items change dynamically depending on whether you look tired or anxious or, flushed with excitement.
So the building itself is essentially reading your mind and reacting.
Exactly. The architecture is constantly rearranging itself, optimizing for one single goal, which is to keep you inside and keep you consuming. And I mean, you would never, ever accept that in the physical world.
No, absolutely not. It sounds like a psychological thriller or a sci-fi horror movie.
Yeah, it really does. But the reality is, you step into that exact architecture every single day.
We all do. We essentially live in it now.
We do, because that is the reality of the digital spaces we inhabit. And the friction between our deeply ingrained human nature and these shifting, highly engineered digital environments is exactly what we are unpacking today.
It's a massive topic, but so crucial to wrap our heads around.
It really is, because you, the listener, you are someone who wants to understand not just what is happening on your screen, but the actual mechanics operating beneath the surface. You want to navigate this incredibly complex information landscape without feeling completely paralyzed by it.
And it is so easy to feel paralyzed right now, given how fast everything is moving.
Exactly. So, welcome to this deep dive. Today, we are exploring a massive interconnected reality. We're looking at how we study, live, adapt, and build communities in digital spaces.
And really, how our physical and digital lives have become so completely entangled that separating them is just, well, it's no longer possible.
Right, it's a profound shift. And to figure out how this digital scaffolding actually works, we have an absolutely fascinating stack of sources to go through today.
We really do. We are pulling from some foundational texts on business anthropology, which is a fascinating field.
Yeah, and we are also looking at academic methodologies on something called netnography. Plus, we are digging deep into public school digital wellness toolkits.
Specifically, the frameworks from Arlington Public Schools and the digital safety organization, CORIA.
Right, exactly. And we are cross-referencing all of that with university research on organizational culture, dark UX patterns, and, the often exhausting realities of remote work.
It might sound like a wildly diverse stack of materials. I mean, going from corporate anthropology to middle school digital safety.
That does sound like a lot.
But they all point toward the exact same underlying thesis. They're all trying to map human behavior in an artificial environment.
Yes, and our mission for this deep dive is to synthesize all of this for you. We want to unpack how human behavior is systematically studied in these digital realms.
And figure out how we navigate the blurring lines between our physical, breathing selves and our virtual identities.
And ultimately, look at how we can protect our digital well-being amidst this incredibly rapid technological change. So, okay, let's unpack this. Where do we even start with a topic this massive?
We need a framework, right? A lens to look through that makes sense of the chaos rather than just getting swept away by it.
I completely agree. So, what is that lens?
Well, if we want to understand human chaos, the absolute best lens we have ever developed is anthropology.
Okay, but we aren't talking about the Indiana Jones version of anthropology here, right?
No, definitely not. When we look at how this applies to the modern world of commerce, software, and human-computer interaction, we're specifically talking about business anthropology.
Which I have to admit, it sounds like a total oxymoron the first time you hear it.
It really does.
Because you picture an anthropologist and you think of someone living with a remote indigenous tribe, taking these meticulous field notes. You don't picture them sitting in a corporate boardroom in Silicon Valley analyzing a supply chain.
That is the traditional academic
Yeah.
view, yeah. And for a long time, that was the strict boundary. But based on Timothy DeWall Malafut's text on business anthropology, the field has undergone a radical evolution.
It's a very pragmatic one, right?
Exactly. It takes those exact same anthropological theories, the systematic ways we study human culture and rituals, and applies them directly to solve real, immediate business challenges.
But it's not just a change of venue, it's a fundamental shift in the actual goal of the work.
How do you mean?
Well, the source material points out that traditional academic anthropology has this very strict do-no-harm ethos. They just want to observe and write critical analyses.
Right, they want to point out the subtle shades of gray.
Yeah, they aren't there to fix the culture, they just document it. But Business anthropology takes an interventionist approach. It steps into the room and says, we are going to actively solve the behavioral problem.
Which brings us to a really fascinating collision, because you have how businesses usually try to solve problems versus how an anthropologist tries to solve them.
The text spends a lot of time contrasting this, doesn't it? It talks about standard business default thinking.
Right. If you go to business school, you are trained in default thinking. It is linear, highly rational, and heavily driven by efficiency.
It's all about deductive reasoning.
Exactly. It looks at a known set of data sales numbers, click-through rates, and tries to extrapolate the most optimized path forward. It's about moving as fast as possible.
It's like using a GPS that only shows you the fastest possible route from point A to point B. It's incredibly efficient if you know exactly what the road looks like.
And if your only goal is speed.
Right. But anthropological thinking is zooming way, way out to look at the entire map. It's looking at the terrain, the weather systems, and asking why you even want to go to point B at all.
That is a perfect analogy. Because while that linear default thinking works brilliantly for optimizing a shipping route, it completely falls apart when you are trying to understand complex human behaviors.
Because humans are irrational.
Highly irrational. Business default thinking looks at a product and immediately asks, how do we sell this? It treats the customer as a revenue stream.
Yeah, that phrase really struck me. Revenue stream is actually a highly militaristic extractive metaphor when you think about it.
It is. It's treating human beings like natural resources to be mined. But anthropology asks a much larger question. Why do people value this?
It wants to know what meaning the object holds in the person's life.
Right. It uses a holistic approach. You can't just isolate a consumer's behavior in one microscopic moment without understanding how it connects to their family structure and cultural identity.
To really drive this home, the sources outline two distinct ways of knowing the world, the attic perspective and the emic perspective.
Yes, these are foundational concepts. The attic perspective is the outsider's view. It's formal, logical, and rational.
It's the language of the boardroom, basically.
Exactly. Spreadsheets, demographic brackets, and KPIs. It categorizes people from the top down.
And the emic perspective.
The emic perspective is the insider's view. It's local, it's informal. And it is deeply rooted in how people actually make sense of their own lived experiences.
So it's how they define their own values, not how a corporation defines them.
Precisely. And the text gives this incredible concrete example involving the brand Adidas that just perfectly illustrates this.
Oh, right. Because Adidas almost missed the boat entirely on one of the biggest fitness trends of the last few decades.
They really did. They were looking at the massive rising phenomenon of yoga.
Yeah.
And from an etic corporate perspective, the executives looked at yoga and asked, is this a sport?
Because if it's a sport, their business logic dictates that the goal is to win.
Right. To beat competitors, push past your limits, and be the absolute best. Because that's how you design and market sports gear.
You market the aggression. So if you are sitting in a boardroom in Germany looking at a spreadsheet, you think, okay, we need to make highly competitive, aerodynamic yoga gear.
Which sounds hilarious to anyone who actually does yoga.
Totally. So what did they actually do?
Well, they realized their eidetic view wasn't working. So they brought in anthropologists to take an emic approach. They immersed themselves in the yoga studios.
And what did they find?
They realized very quickly that people aren't packing into these hot studios to crush their opponents. There is no yoga championship they're training for.
They weren't trying to beat the person on the mat next to them.
Exactly. People were engaging in yoga for holistic lifestyle benefits, for mental well-being, stress relief, and to find a sanctuary away from their high-pressure jobs.
The value wasn't in competition at all. It was in personal balance.
And understanding that fundamental emic difference completely revolutionized how Adidas approached the market.
It changed how they designed the fabrics, right? Making them softer and more comfortable for daily wear.
Yeah, rather than just high-performance armor. If they had stuck to their etic thinking, they would have alienated their entire potential customer base by aggressively marketing a relaxing activity.
But what's truly fascinating here is how the anthropologist actually arrived at that emic understanding. It requires something called a reflexive stance.
Right. Reflexivity is the rigorous practice of evaluating your own biases. It's examining your own cultural assumptions and actively questioning how your presence alters the environment.
So it's acknowledging that you aren't an invisible, objective camera. You are a human being with baggage.
Precisely. You have to actively acknowledge your own limits to genuinely empathize with the people you are studying.
If the Adidas researchers hadn't been reflexive, they would have walked in, seen people sweating, and just said, yep, it's a sport.
Exactly. They would have projected their own biases. And, you know, this empathy is actually something we could use a lot more of in how we design workplace tools today.
Oh, definitely. Like what?
Well, think about encouraging mentorship and coaching AI features to help people upskill. If we use an emic approach, we wouldn't design AI to just ruthlessly monitor productivity.
Right, like an algorithmic boss constantly breathing down your neck.
Exactly. Instead, we design coaching AI features that actually understand the user's emotional state, gently nudging them to learn new skills in a supportive, empathetic way.
That makes so much sense. It's using technology to build people up rather than just extract value from them.
Exactly. But, you know, studying human behavior is one thing when you can observe people in a physical room, like a yoga studio or an office.
Right. What happens when the studio or the office evaporates into the cloud? What happens when human culture moves entirely online?
That is the pivotal transition we are living through. And it created a massive crisis in the field of anthropology.
Because the traditional toolkit was insufficient.
Completely insufficient for studying a subreddit or a Discord server. We needed a new paradigm. We had to move from traditional ethnography to netnography.
Netnography. I have to say, it sounds like something out of a cyberpunk novel from 1995.
Well, the timeline is actually spot on. It was conceptualized by Robert Cousinets in the late 90s, right as the early web was forming distinct communities.
So what is it exactly?
It is the adaptation of ethnographic methods to internet communities. It's specialized to study the digital traces people leave behind and the cybercultures they build.
The sources make the really profound point about the difference between offline and online observation. In a physical setting, face-to-face interactions are ephemeral.
Right. You say something, and a second later, the moment is gone.
If the researcher doesn't write it down right then, it is lost to history. But online, that dynamic flips completely.
Yes. Those textual interactions and memes create a permanent, searchable archive. That is the defining feature of digital culture.
And netnography uses those artifacts to reverse engineer the culture. But it requires a completely different kind of logic, doesn't it?
It does. It relies heavily on something called abductive reasoning.
Okay, let's translate this. We know deductive reasoning, that's Sherlock Holmes, and inductive is taking specific observations to make a broad generalization. But what is abductive reasoning?
Abductive reasoning is essentially creative hypothesis generation. It is looking at a complex, messy set of traces, like a bizarre string of inside jokes on a forum, and trying to find the most plausible explanation for why that behavior is happening.
And the text says it's non-monotonic, meaning it doesn't move in a straight line.
Exactly. Your conclusions are fluid. Finding a new piece of evidence might force you to rearrange the entire board.
You aren't testing a rigid theory. You are letting the messy reality suggest new theories to you.
Right.
But I have to push back here. Isn't ethnography just a fancy academic word for lurking on Reddit? What makes this an actual science?
That is a highly common critique. But what separates it from just data mining is the depth of the inquiry. It is deep, reflexive, cultural immersion.
So they aren't just scraping keywords.
No, they look at the entire ecosystem, the platform affordances, the shared symbols, the moderation rules. They capture the cyberculture, not just the data.
The text highlights that netnography is relationally hybrid, which basically means refuting the old idea that cyberspace and the real world are two separate universes.
Exactly. In the 90s, people thought you logged on and left the real world behind. But netnography assumes they are inextricably woven together.
And it has a critical, transformative stance. It actively looks to challenge power dynamics online.
Yes. It asks, who owns this space, who writes the algorithms, and who is being exploited?
Which brings us to the social roles people play online. The research identifies creators, collectors, critics, joiners, spectators, and inactives.
And the breakdown of those roles completely shatters the illusion that the internet is an equal democratic public square.
The statistics on this are wild.
Yeah.
The sources cite the famous 99-Twan rule.
Right, established by Jacob Nielsen.
So if you take a community of 100 people online, 90% of those users are what researchers call lurkers. They read, they watch, but they virtually never comment.
Then you have 9% who are intermittent contributors.
And then the 1%. That tiny group is producing 90% of the content that the rest of the ecosystem consumes.
Which presents a massive methodological challenge. Mm. If you only analyze the text, you are only listening to the loudest 1%.
You are mistaking the megaphone for the crowd. But do those 90% even matter if they aren't talking?
They matter immensely. their page views, their dwell time, how long they linger on a post, tell the algorithms what is popular. The silent 90% drive the visibility of the 1%.
Okay, so up to this point, we've been talking about humans interacting with humans. But netnography is undergoing another evolution because the internet is no longer just for humans.
This is a critical pivot.
Mm.
We are shifting into a more than human netnography. We have to account for non-human agency.
Like algorithms and bots. This traces back to actor network theory, or ANT.
Yes. ANT argues that technology is not just a passive medium. The technology itself is an active participant that shapes social reality.
But how does a piece of code have agency?
Think about what algorithms actually do. They objectify human behavior. Every time you pause your thumb over a video, the algorithm captures that psychological moment and translates it into computer code.
And then it uses that to dictate what you see next. It's curating reality.
Exactly. And by curating reality, it alters who you interact with. The algorithm has agency because it acts on its own programmed imperatives to keep your attention.
And businesses know this. The exploitation of this behavioral data leads directly to the creation of dark patterns in UX design.
Dark patterns are the weaponization of behavioral psychology. They are design choices crafted to trick or manipulate users into taking actions they didn't intend to take.
This study from the DAVA portal highlights specific mechanisms like sneaking.
Sneaking is a classic.
You go to checkout online, and right as you are about to pay, you realize the total is higher. The system automatically snuck an extended warranty into your basket.
And to get rid of it, you have to hunt for a tiny, almost invisible X.
Why does that work so well?
Decision fatigue. By the checkout page, your brain's executive function is depleted. You just want the task to be over. The designers are monetizing your cognitive exhaustion.
That is so predatory. And the researchers point out that these systems promote pseudo-sharing. It feels like social interaction, but it's just a mechanism for behavioral extraction.
Right. The system has a singular goal: keep you clicking. It pursues this with zero regard for ethical implications or your mental health.
This actually brings up a huge point. With all these dark patterns, how do we even spot them? We need a way to catch dark patterns in these digital services before they drain our wallets or our energy.
We really do. Some researchers are advocating for automated audits, basically using AI to flag when a website is deploying known dark patterns like artificial scarcity timers.
Oh, like those countdown clocks that say only two left at this price, but they just reset when you refresh the page.
Exactly. We need tools that act as a defense mechanism against those manipulative interfaces.
And this constant algorithmic manipulation deeply affects how we present ourselves, which brings us to digital identity and online masking.
To understand this, we have to lean on the sociologist Irving Goffman. He distinguished between the front stage and the backstage of our lives.
The front stage is the public performance. You in a meeting wearing professional clothes.
And the backstage is your private sanctuary. You at home in sweatpants where you don't have to perform.
In the physical world, the boundary is a literal door. But remote work has completely obliterated those boundaries. The home has become highly visible to colleagues.
The academic term for this is strategic invisibility. You want to be visible enough that your boss knows you're working, but invisible enough that they don't see your personal life.
And this digital masking requires a tremendous amount of cognitive energy. The research by Kritika examines the psycho-emotional costs of this, particularly for neurodivergent individuals.
For a neurodivergent person, masking might be a safety skill to reduce judgment. But maintaining that mask constantly on a video call is profoundly exhausting.
We see a similar dual nature with how digital tools affect people with disabilities. A scholar named Wu examined how video conferencing affects people who stutter.
Yes, Wu identifies a double-edged digital masking. On one side, features like muting the mic or using text chat provide immediate relief.
They don't have to face the stress of speaking fluently in front of a grid of staring colleagues.
But on the other side, relying on text chat reinforces the ableist assumption that perfectly fluent speech is the only acceptable standard.
It's a technological band-aid that ignores the cultural wound. And this intense focus on digital performance ties into a massive loss of workplace social capital.
The traditional coffee room conversation has been swallowed up by digital channels. Connection is now a scheduled front stage performance.
Right, like a forced 15-minute virtual coffee chat. It leads to profound information overload.
But humans are adaptable. People are finding creative ways to cope, using AI chatbots and VR avatars as stigma-free social proxies.
So, like using generative AI to draft a difficult email so you don't have to ask a human colleague to read it 5 times.
Exactly. The AI never sighs or judges you. You don't face embarrassment.
And people use VR avatars to experiment with self-presentation in ways that feel too risky in the physical world.
It is a delicate psychological balance.
Which brings to mind the work of Marie Jahoda. Are you familiar with her criteria for mental health well-being?
Yes, absolutely. Jahoda proposed that ideal mental health isn't just the absence of illness. It involves things like autonomy, an accurate perception of reality, and environmental mastery.
Environmental mastery feels so relevant here.
It really is. In the physical world, you have some mastery over your environment. But in the digital world, the algorithms and dark patterns are constantly undermining your autonomy.
And your perception of reality is being distorted by curated feeds. How can anyone maintain Jahoda's criteria for well-being when the digital architecture is actively fighting against it?
It's incredibly difficult. And it becomes significantly more alarming when we look at how younger generations are interacting with non-human actors.
Right. Adults know the AI drafting the email is a predictive text model. But kids are forming deep emotional attachments to AI chatbots.
This brings us to youth digital wellness. Kids are treating AI not as calculators, but as genuine friends.
The Arlington Public Schools Toolkit calls out features in platforms like Snapchat, specifically their My AI chatbot.
It sits right next to the message from their real best friend, and the platform deliberately encourages personification.
Kids rename the AI, customize its avatar, and start asking it for deep emotional support. But this is an incredibly risky psychological experiment.
We are systematically blurring the line between human empathy and machine interaction. An AI does not care about you. It is performing empathy, not feeling it.
And the truly dark part is that the platform is storing all that intimate chat data. The friend is actually a data miner.
Which is why we desperately need human-in-the-loop methods for these LLMs and AI services.
Wait, human-in-the-loop, what does that mean in this context?
It means we cannot let these autonomous AI models interact with vulnerable populations without a human layer of oversight.
Ah, so if a teenager starts talking to an AI about a mental health crisis, the AI shouldn't just generate a generic, unchecked response.
Exactly. The system should recognize the risk and seamlessly loop in a real human counselor or flag it for human review. We can't outsource emotional triage to a machine.
That makes total sense. And this risk is why organizations like Coria are pushing for a systemic shift in digital wellness.
The old model of reactive punitive monitoring is broken. Scanning a web browser for bad words and handing out detentions is insufficient.
Because it generates a massive amount of false positives. A keyword scanner can't tell the difference between historical research and a mental health crisis.
So Coria advocates for capturing the active student voice. The goal is early detection of harm so a human can intervene.
It's shifting from digital policing to digital duty of care. And true digital wellness requires student education and empowering parents.
The Arlington Toolkit provides a 5-step approach for families. Step one is building a culture of curiosity without immediate judgment.
Step two is teaching critical thinking and media literacy. Kids need to understand how algorithms shaped the world.
Step three is co-creating digital boundaries through a family tech agreement.
Step four is encouraging creation over passive consumption. And step five is staying informed as technology mutates.
It is a deeply empathetic framework.
But, you know, hearing all this, I keep thinking we need something more formalized. Like, we go to the doctor once a year for a physical checkup.
Right.
Why don't we have an idea for a digital health checkup every year for a child or an adult?
That is an absolutely brilliant concept, a digital health checkup.
Yeah. You sit down with a digital wellness professional or even just take a formalized self-assessment to look at your screen time, your emotional reaction to your feeds, and your privacy settings.
I love that. It would force us to actively review our digital habits, check for signs of algorithmic burnout, and recalibrate our boundaries before we hit a crisis point.
Exactly. Because setting up safe digital scaffolding is incredibly hard. And it's not just families who struggle. Massive public organizations fail miserably at digital transformation.
Yes, we see this in a fascinating study from Linnaeus University. When organizations spend millions on new digital tools, the primary obstacle is almost never the technology.
It's the organizational culture.
Exactly. When a new tool is introduced from the top down without transparency, employees intuitively resist.
And that resistance looks like dysfunctional use.
When tools are forced on employees for political reasons rather than usability, their effort expectancy skyrockets.
They put up an emotional barrier. There was a brilliant quote from the study talking about training manuals.
Participant 4, they said the manuals must be written for the 50-year-old ladies who will use the tool, not the IT developers.
That perfectly encapsulates the clash between the etic and emic perspectives. The executives designed a tool for themselves, not the user.
The study also brought up the thesis printing example. A university forced the physical printing of theses despite having digital repositories.
Because someone had a political deal with a printing company, it completely ignored logic.
And when technology disrupts the social fabric like that, the culture will always defeat it. People will bypass the system.
We see this deeply ingrained human resistance in a beautiful way with the concept of glocalization in digital norms.
Glocalization is how massive global technological trends are adapted to fit highly specific local cultural realities.
The ethnography focused on rural Orthodox communities in Romania and how they handle the rituals of death and mourning.
You'd assume global social media would overwrite their ancient traditions.
But the ethnographers found the opposite. These communities used digital platforms to aggressively reinforce their offline traditional practices.
They used Facebook to organize the physical wakes and call the diaspora back to the village.
They ensured the technology served their culture rather than the other way around. It is a powerful example of cultural resilience.
And this tension between technology and human culture is only going to get more intense as we move toward multi-agent autonomous systems.
Wait, what are multi-agent autonomous systems?
We are talking about physical AI applications. Mm-hmm. Think of smart office environments where multiple AI agents like delivery robots, smart climate control, and automated scheduling systems all interact with each other in the physical world without human input.
Oh, wow. So not just software on a screen, but robots actively moving around us.
Exactly. And this requires a massive amount of careful thinking. Because if these agents are programmed purely with that linear, evagatic business mindset, just pure efficiency, they could severely damage our well-being.
Right. Because we do not want agents to act in a hustle culture way. Imagine an AI office manager robot constantly nudging you to work faster or interrupting your deep work because it determined you've been sitting too long.
Or aggressively optimizing a warehouse floor in a way that treats human workers like obstacles rather than people. We have to design these physical AI systems so they don't violate or harm our digital and physical well-being.
It all comes back to empathy and an understanding the emic perspective. We have covered an incredible amount of ground today.
We really have.
The core lesson is that whether we are talking about a university administrator refusing to use a clunky database or a Romanian village organizing a funeral on Facebook, human culture will always push back.
We are not passive recipients of technology. We are in a constant daily negotiation with these digital tools.
We started by looking at how business anthropology uses empathy to understand the profound why behind our actions.
We examined ethnography and how it tracks our cybercultures, and we expanded that to include more than human actors and dark patterns.
We pulled back the curtain on our digital identities, front stage and backstage masking, and the urgent need to protect our youth from AI companions.
And we saw how organizational cultures resist top-down digital transformations that fail to respect human reality.
Before we let you go, I want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over.
We've discussed how algorithms and AI act as non-human actors shaping our reality. But consider this tension.
Yeah, what happens when we train these massive AI models on our own daily behavior and then rely on them to teach us and guide our social norms?
Are we creating an inescapable psychological feedback loop? We must ask ourselves, are we actively programming our own cultural evolution, or have we already handed the script over to the machine?
It's a heavy question. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive. Stay curious, stay critical of the digital architecture around you, and we'll catch you next time.